memorize, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you, please be seated. Good morning, welcome to the second hearing of the day in the Hopewell Term of Court, the Idaho Supreme Court. This matter is an appeal involving, help me with the first, who's?
Ego.
I'm so sorry. Ego versus the State of Eric Milo Hernan. And we have Mr. Kyle May representing Cindy Uzo, Jody Hernan and John White, and Mr. Andrew Hart is assisting him today. We have Mr. Greg Baker representing Vicki Berryman and the Alderman Jacobs. Good morning to all. Is there any preliminary matters?
Not at this time, unless you have.
Very well then. I appreciate you. We've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, sir. You may proceed.
Would you like me to approach here to argue? Or?
Yes, please, sir. We can hear you better from the prison court.
May it please the court. My name is Kyle May, and I represent the appellants in this matter. I'm asking for the court today to overturn the district court's decision affirming the magistrate in an award of attorney's fees and costs as to all phases of the litigation. I want this court to know that there are two major issues I think the court is going to be deciding today. First is whether Idaho Code 153-720, which is the probate statute to grant attorney's fees and costs, whether that statute is going to be treated differently from any of the other civil statutes in awarding attorney's fees and costs. The second one is does a magistrate court, who is a lower court, have the authority to, I guess would say, overturn this court or ignore its directive from this court with the decision of their decision with regard to attorney's fees and costs. I have made some slides for the court here today that are illustrative for the court to be able to understand a little bit better. The procedural history is took a very peculiar, route in this. And so I would like the court to be able to see that. I think if you do, it will help you better understand. Phase one, as stated up there, is the attorney's fees and costs that were litigated in front of the magistrate when the administration of the estate took place. That was before the magistrate. There was $9,000 in fees and $357.48 in costs that were accumulated during that part and was awarded from the estate. The second phase is attorney fees and costs that were accumulated at the intermediate appeal in front of the district court. And then the phase three is the attorney fees and costs that were accumulated in front of this court from the first appeal. The amount of attorney fees and costs in those two phases together was $26,948 in fees. And then the last one...
Did you break those down between phase two and phase three?
I believe I did that in my briefing. I have them right here. I have them together because part of the argument in phase two and phase three, my argument goes together with the rate judicata argument that I'm going to make today. And then the last phase is phase four, which obviously is still, as of right now, we don't know the total amount because it's phase four is from the magistrate to the appellate level to now this level with regarding the attorney's fees and costs. So this case started with the court awarding first phase of fees, as the chart shows, it kind of starts where it starts. We appealed that decision that went up to the district court. I think this court is aware at the district court level, it was an interesting thing that happened was when we made argument, we submitted briefing. And when we appealed it after the statute that allowed the administration of the estate, if you have a closing order, to appeal it. Um, and, Judge Simpson, who was the district judge at that time, said, no, we need a final judgment, according to the Eisman decision, and we need to have a final judgment in this matter. So after the briefing was all submitted, argument was made, a judgment was remanded back down to the magistrate, Judge Hansen, to enter a judgment. At that time, a judgment was entered regarding all of the issues that we had appealed up to the district court at that level. The only issue that wasn't appealed was actually the attorney's fees and costs issue, because at that point it wasn't right, because there was no memorandum of fees and costs ever submitted in regarding to claiming those fees.
Right, but in the final accounting, the magistrate court had already awarded $9,000 for attorney's fees for phase one, right?
In the final accounting, he did award that. However, in all civil matters, I've done this before other judges, is that they do award an amount of fees, but there's still a requirement that you have to, after an order is issued or a final judgment, 14 days from that, you have to file a memorandum of fees and costs to show the reasonableness of the fees, because if you fail to do that, according to Iowa Rules Civil Procedure 54, then you waive those fees according to that statute.
So you're saying the court orders the fees first and then asks for the proof substantiating the amount after the award?
I've had that several times where they order fees on the front end and say, I'm going to award you attorney's fees and costs. You then have to submit your memorandum of fees and costs still, because the court is still required to make a reasonableness analysis as to what those are, meaning they have to go through your memorandum, they have to decide what the extent of the case, how difficult it was, all of those factors, they have to make that decision. And this court, previously in Bailey v. Bailey, which it actually talks specifically about Iowa Code 153720, states specifically that that statute applies to the Iowa Rules Civil Procedure 54. Meaning that you have to make that analysis according to 54. And actually, that whole case is about the fact that the judge didn't make a reasonableness analysis in awarding the fees.
Is there a difference, though, between awarding costs as fees as somewhat of a sanction for being a losing party and asserting a losing argument that was baseless versus awarding fees as a cost of administration, which appears to be how the district court looked at this?
So what I would say is that the Bailey Court, which was the prior court, ruled that it didn't matter whether it was a sanctionable or not. When you make a decision based upon a statute, which this is what he's doing, he's not doing it off a sanction. If the accounting would have said that, the award, the basis for the award was under 153S720, which allows a personal representative to receive attorney's fees and costs from the state as long as it is persecuted in good faith. Whether if you lose or win. And so the court, one, still has to make the analysis whether it's frivolous or without foundation, because I believe there's still good faith standard. But then, you still have to make the reasonableness determination if you are going to award it pursuant to a statute, which Magistrate Hansen did this time. And that's why it is required that you still have to do a 14-day memorandum and affidavit of fees and costs.
I'm wondering why, if there's no allegation of bad faith, while the reasonableness has to be determined by the court. I don't know if you've ever served as a personal representative before. I did one time when after both my parents died. And fortunately, I didn't have to hire an attorney to defend against claims of the heirs. They were all happy with how I dealt with it. But if one of the heirs had been unhappy with me, and I had had to hire a retainer, and in good faith, I defended the interests of the other heirs and the interests of the estate, and I got billed maybe more than I thought was reasonable by an attorney, but I had to pay it anyway. Why should I have to prove it's reasonable in order to get reimbursed for my attorney's fees and doing my job as a personal representative?
And the only reason why I say that is that I point to the Supreme Court case law on Bailey v. Bailey, which that case, this court and the Supreme Court, ruled that you have to do the reasonableness analysis if you're finding under a statute, according to the rules. So the rules say you have to, and that's from our point of view is the reason why you're still required to, no matter what, as a judge, to make that analysis.
The reasonableness analysis for attorney's fees awarded because of the quality of the argument made under Rule 54 lists a whole bunch of factors to determine reasonableness. Would those same factors apply if we're talking about reimbursing the cost of administration, or would the reasonableness be looked at by a different standard other than Rule 54?
As from what I understand, from what Bailey says, as of right now, it would be the same. It would be the same factors, because that's what the court has said. And so that's what I'm following today with my argument, and the authority that I have is that this court has said you're required to do it. And so
I think what Justice Marlowe is asking is, does it make sense that the Rule 54 standards would apply under these circumstances?
I would believe so. I think, you know, I think it's fair to be able to go in and you have to still submit a, you know, list of your attorney's fees and costs. And I think the judge, it would be fair for them to still have to make an analysis as to say, yeah, this is not just only that it relates to the state, but the time and the amount of time you spent on something according to the state, was that reasonable? Should I grant you that much time as a personal representative doing something on this? If I find that, I think that was way too much time on something, because I think that's what the factors determine. And I think that you as judges still have to make that analysis, because for beneficiaries who, again, this is money being taken from the estate. The beneficiaries are losing money here if more money goes to the personal representative. And just because, and my point in the way the probate statute, if a beneficiary comes in and attacks and says, I don't think you're doing something right, and
even if they still lose. Counsel, it's not going to the personal representative. It's going to the personal representative's attorney.
Yes, but it's the personal representatives are the ones who are requesting, so they don't have to pay it back personally.
Exactly, but let's say you're not talking about attorney's fees. Let's say in order to probate an estate, there needs to be a division of property, and so you hire a surveyor to do that. Okay, and then the personal representative hires a surveyor and gets a bill. And then they submit that as a cost of administration so they can get reimbursed for that off the top. Obviously, that's going to if the personal representative also happens to be an heir, they're going to get a little less, and everybody else is going to get a little less paying for that. If the other side says, oh, you paid too much for that survey, it was not reasonable, don't they have the responsibility to prove it's not reasonable if they're going to make that allegation? You don't have to come to court, ask reimbursement for a survey, and then present a witness to say that survey was a reasonable cost.
Right. Well, for example, say you do an estate and maybe the heirs get in late or something and they weren't able to see the bill. And so then you're saying, well, he doesn't even have to file a memorandum showing what that is or what that cost is in an accounting. For example, if he didn't get an accounting because they closed the estate, and you would say, whoa, this was X amount of money. I want to determine the reasonableness of that.
I guess what I'm saying, to be clear, is isn't it the burden of the people saying it's unreasonable to present evidence that it's unreasonable?
No, because I believe that if the personal representative is the one who has the duty, the fiduciary obligation to the estate, which is a higher duty, you have to act and transact business on behalf of the beneficiaries. You're required to make it good for the estate. And so if you're going to go out and say hire somebody that is way more than anybody else, I think you're required to account for that to the beneficiaries of the estate.
I think you're required to account. No one's contesting that. But I'm just wondering why anyone would want to be a personal representative if they felt like they were going to have to go to court and call witnesses to defend every expenditure they make on behalf of the estate.
And I would just say to that answer, you already do. You have to go into the accounting if the person objects, and you have to show, there's already case law in Idaho that says, you have to show every expenditure is related to the estate for you to be able to get that expenditure.
That's a little different, though, than saying, proving that the amount of the expenditure is a reasonable amount and they weren't overcharged for it.
But in my opinion, I understand where you're at. I would say that I still think because of the fiduciary obligation of the personal representative still has that obligation to do that. And so, again, at this point in time, there is a judgment issued. My argument, I think, is pretty clear. I think the court is aware that I believe they waived that right. Once the judgment was entered, no affidavit, no memorandum of fees and costs, which Bailey was outlined in this court, says they were required to do so. They never put one. Now, with regards to phase one, I believe that then, at that point, they waive their right to attorney's fees and costs. And so I think the court should overturn that decision to the magistrate because they waived that pursuant to rule.
Does 15.3.7.21, the process set out in there, override Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 54, because 15.3.7.21 is specific to proceedings for review of employment of agents and compensation of personal representatives and employees of a state. It talks about notice to all interested persons, talks about propriety of employment, compensation of any employee of the estate, including attorneys, auditors, etc., and provides for a process to review those fees. Isn't that the more specific process here? And doesn't that feed into Justice Mueller's argument that the process in probate is the PR submits the information, provides it to all interested parties, and if the interested parties want to contest it, then they do that before the court?
So I think the 721 statute falls in line with the 715 statute. That 715 statute is a statute which gives duties and powers of personal representatives to hire people for employment. And specifically, the 22 and 21, it talks about they have a right to hire an attorney for the estate, just like beneficiaries have a right to hire an attorney as well. The 721 procedure, which is a special proceeding, what I say that is basically, if I want to go in and say, I don't want this attorney to be the estate attorney, I can go in and argue at that point in time and say, I don't want him to be the attorney of the estate. And that's what that proceeding is for 721, not determining fees, because that's the 720 statute. It's the attack whether you actually want that person employed to the estate.
But the statute says specifically it's the reasonableness of the compensation determined by the person representative for loan services. The reasonableness of the compensation of any person so employed, it says, may be reviewed by the court. I mean, it's more than just approving the person.
And the compensation is that, for example, when a personal representative goes and hires an individual, he understands that at that point he's hiring them for the estate, but also to represent themselves. In this matter, it was both. So, because he represented both the personal representatives and the estate at the same time. But at that point, you don't get fees from the estate. You don't get fees from the estate, which makes all the beneficiaries have to pay for that compensation until one, even whether it turns into a proceeding of whether you're fighting for something. And again, these fees are different because these fees are about a proceeding in which you're arguing and having to go to court for. This is just for an employment compensation, right? And so I would say there's a distinguish because you have to show that there was good faith, right, to be able to get the fees to be paid from the estate, and you have to show that it wasn't frivolous. For the personal representative, their position that they're taking in the proceeding wasn't that way, so they can get paid from the estate attorney or the estate. You can take money out of the estate to pay for their attorney that they hired. So moving on from that, is my second argument, which is in regards to res judicata and claim preclusion. The appeal went up to the district court. The district court, the first decision, basically, in his decision, he did not grant any attorney's fees and costs on his first decision. Then the respondents filed a repetition and said, look, we should get attorney's fees and costs on that appeal under 12-121. And not only that, but they argued that they should get fees under 15-8208, and they argued that they should get fees under 15-3710. They argued all three of those statutes at the time of the intermediate appeal in front of the district judge. The court granted attorney's fees and costs under 12-121 at that time. He denied them under 15-8208, and then the court did not mention 15-3720 at all. He didn't make a decision to that. We immediately appealed that decision, and in front of you, we asked the court to overturn basis on the 12-121 decision. This court did overturn him with that under 12-121. Before that, the respondents did do a cross appeal, but their cross appeal, and I believe it was in relation to 15-3720, was denied because of timeliness. So at that point, with 15-3720 fees, the request at the time of the intermediate appeal became extinguished, done. It was finished at that point in time because they didn't cross-appeal it, and we didn't appeal it, and so therefore the decision to not grant fees under that statute, it became a final, and it extinguished that right under 15-3720.
But if if the estate didn't receive an adverse ruling on the 15-3-720 claim, why is that a proper subject of a cross appeal? You have to have an adverse ruling in order to file a cross appeal.
Well, under issue part of the premises is that if you have the ability to raise any issue that is related at the time and you don't, then at that point in time, you don't get to raise the issue at a later point. That issue is now done and moot.
It's never been ruled on.
It was ruled on because the judge didn't find an awarding under that statute. They could have repetitioned under that. They could have then cross-appealed and said, look, Judge Simpson did wrong. He shouldn't have found under 12-121. He should have found under 15-3-720 in this court. And brought that to the court's attention.
But the estate won in front of Judge Simpson.
One issue was remanded back down in regarding the personal representative compensation fees at that time. So they didn't win on everything. There was one issue that was not found in their favor. And they had to do findings of facts and conclusions of the law in front of the magistrate court at that time. Only with the personal representative compensation. So at that point, I would argue then 15-3-720 was litigated. Not only that, but they had every opportunity to litigate that.
Well, why does the BR want to take a cross appeal when they won below? I'm so struggling with Justice Burby's question. When the PR wins, why is it necessary for the PR to take a cross appeal when they prevail?
Because the rule in this court, if you are to be able to get fees and costs, one, you have to assert them on appeal. If you don't, you don't get them. If they're not awarded to you, and then you decide not to challenge that ruling, that ruling now becomes finished. And that's what happened. The ruling was the judge said it didn't grant it. And so they could have cross appealed, they could have challenged that, but they did not. And so because they didn't, that issue became done at that point at the intermediate appeal. So the fact that now they're getting 15-3-720 fees for the intermediate appeal, it should not, because it's res judicata. There was an adjudication. They had every right. The parties were the same, the estate, the personal representatives. Everybody was there. Everybody could have litigated it.
Is this really a race judicata argument, or is it more of just a failure to raise argument?
No, they raised it. That's the thing. They asserted it. In their decision for their petition for a rehearing, which is in their briefing, they specifically state, the district court's attention is directly drawn to our arguments at pages 10 and 11 of the respondent's brief, which is restated here for the court's convenience. In that argument, we identify the statutory authority you rely upon. I oppose section 15-8208 and 15-3-720. We respond also relies upon I oppose 15-720, which provides a material part, and then they cite the actual statute. They were asking Judge Simpson to grant fees under that statute, and he did not.
Where is that in the record?
That is their briefing for their petition for rehearing. I believe I've cited that in my briefing.
So my first question is, do you have any legal authority for the premise that res judicata applies to judgments within the same case? It strikes me this is law of the case and this is not res judicata, because res judicata applies to judgments from a different case that you want to apply in the current case.
And it's a good question, but I would say that's where the district court went. The district court said, look, under Caps v. Wood, this is law of the case doctrine instead of res judicata. However, I would disagree with them because the Caps v. Wood case was different. And the difference was is that when it went up to the Supreme Court, you guys reversed completely everything in the Caps v. Wood case and sent it back down to the magistrate. And so therefore, there was no final decision because everything was still open at that point.
But doesn't res judicata imply at least two actions? This case is only one action. So how could it ever apply?
Res judicata applies to prior adjudications. I would say that.
But isn't it assumed in a res judicata you have at least two actions, not the same case,
well,
two separate cases?
The case law specific says that res judicata is what is prior adjudication, which if you want to interpret that to be two cases or however you interpret that, but I would say it's a prior proceeding, whether if it's not.
Interpret it your way. Then it really is no different than the law of the case, is it?
Well, the law of the case seems to suggest that the law of the case basically it follows the same principles as res judicata. I mean, it says, along the case approach, this is Judge Simpson, discourages piecemeal appeals and is consistent with the broad scope of claim preclusion under an analogous doctrine of the res judicata.
Except law of the case is different, because law of the case says, if in deciding a case, the court relies on a principle or rule of law necessary to the decision, that pronouncement, that decision on that aspect of the law, becomes the law of the case and must be adhered to throughout subsequent progress. So the fact that Judge Simpson did not rule on or address their request under 15.3.7.20 suggests there's no preclusive effect here. He just didn't address it. The law of the case is his ruling on the TEDRA request and the 12.1.21 request.
So then my thing would be this, then, with that analogy, is that anything that you as the Supreme Court doesn't address, or the district court, if it wasn't addressed and brought up, somehow we never have a conclusion of those issues.
Right.
So you can always come back at a later point and continue to litigate and reopen everything? That would be
it hasn't been resolved, it's not the law of the case.
But it is going to be resolved because the law of the case talks about if you have the opportunity to raise them during those decisions, and it just specifically says, however, the law of the case can bar courts from considering issues previously raised or which should have been raised. Not just only raised, but which should have been raised. They should have raised, and not only that, they did raise it. And not only that, should it have been raised? Yes, it should have. They should have said, we don't agree with your decision under 15.3.7.20. That was their right, their argument as a litigator. They should have done that, and they didn't. Now, we go to the Supreme Court level. They didn't cite 15.3.7.20 to ask for fees.
And we didn't resolve it.
But this court said, no attorney's fees and costs on appeal. No attorney's fees and costs on appeal.
Under 12.1.21 in TEDRA.
That's not what the court said. The court said, neither party is awarded costs or attorney's fees on appeal. That's the decision of this court.
Actually, the decision was consequently the district court abused its discretion in awarding the estate attorney's fees under Idaho Code Section 12.1.21.
And then on that appeal, the Supreme Court appeal, neither party is awarded costs or attorney's fees on appeal. That's what the decision was.
Which does not address the fees awarded in Phase 1.
And I guess the question is under Idaho Appellate Rule 4041, when you guys, and there's multiple case laws in Idaho that say, if you fail to assert a statute for attorney's fees and costs, you don't get them. If you don't assert the statute in the appeal, you don't get those.
So you're saying that every probate action, if the person initiating a probate doesn't set forth the statute by which they have a right to reimbursement, if they have to hire an attorney, the personal representative can't be reimbursed?
No, they can't. If they assert the statute on it, when it goes to an appeal, they assert 15.3.7.20 at the end of the appeal.
How many probate actions do you believe in Idaho have been filed that included such a request?
That under 15.3.7.20?
Yeah. Well, at the time the probate was filed, that they made that request.
So, I'm not sure about the amount of appeals, but I know Bowman, the case in Bowman, which was brought in front of the Supreme Court, which I've cited, you guys specifically hold in there that that someone can be awarded under attorney's fees and costs under 15.3.7.20. And you held that when they asserted it on the appeal. And so, that is the standard procedure that any time when you're on an appeal, when you go up, you don't just get attorney's fees and costs forever. For each appeal is a different level. For each appeal, you have to assert attorney's fees and costs. And then you do Idaho Appellate Rule 4041, which then you go to the court and you say, here's my memorandum of fees and costs after decision. Please award me these fees that they're reasonable.
But that's when you're seeking fees against an opposing party, as opposed to seeking reimbursement for expenses from the estate.
And that's the question, I guess, is brought before the court. Is the court going to decide that 15.3.7.20 is a different statute and doesn't meet those requirements as every regular civil statute, which you guys require? Or is it something else? Because as of right now, there is no decision. The Bailey case seems to suggest to me that says it's just like any other civil statute. It's treated just like any other civil statute. You've got to follow the rules under Idaho Rules of Civil Procedure 54. You've got to do a memorandum of fees and costs, and you have to do that. And if you don't, you don't get them.
course, most people that undertake the responsibility to be a personal representative don't assume they're going to be up to the Supreme Court twice.
I get it. I understand that. And I'm not sure how many cases or probate cases you guys see in a year either. But the rules that I have in front of me seem to suggest that. And I would say that when a immediate appeal district, Judge Simpson, when he rules a decision, you guys rule a decision, and you don't argue those, those seem to me, does extinguish the case. If I go up to the Supreme Court and a decision and opinion is made, I don't get to come back and attack it at a later point. It's done. It's finished. That is the decision. There's nowhere else to go. Unless I want to do a writ of certiorari and go over to the federal courts, at that point it's extinguished and all the issues are done. And that's what happened. There wasn't 15-3-7-20, wasn't asserted at the Supreme Court. You guys held, there's no more attorney's fees and costs. You sent it back down to the district court. You said vacate your award of attorney's fees and costs because
under 12-121.
But if they wanted them, they should have cross-appealed. And you guys could have decided and said, yeah, you don't get them under 12-121, but you get them under 15-3-7-20.
I just saw showing object in your comment there. What in this decision would fall under the jurisdiction of the federal courts?
No, I'm saying if after the decision, maybe you misheard me, was after the Supreme Court was finished and I didn't agree with that, the only way that I believe that I could go, as my understanding, would have to try to do something over to the federal court.
Or something
to that extent.
I'm asking, what is it in this proceeding that would invoke the jurisdiction of the federal court on any subject?
There's nothing in this one that would. I was saying hypothetically.
Okay.
Sorry.
So I believe you're out of time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
It please the court. I am going to draw a clear distinction between 12-121 and the fee shifting provisions and 720, which is not a fee shifting provision. And if you bear with me, let me go back 51 years to 1971. When I was first admitted to practice and took over a number of cases under the old probate procedure. The new probate procedure was adopted in 71, but was not applicable to those prior existing cases. And what we had to do under the old system is we had to go to court to get approval for everything. We had to go to court to get an appraiser approved. We had to go to court to get appraiser fees approved. We had to go to court for every step. And part of the reason was is that system supported what was then the state inheritance tax provision, because it was the decision out of the probate court that drove the values in the inheritance tax provision. And so one was really necessary for the other. The old statute also had, and what I want to focus on, is a mandatory fee provision. Attorneys got paid 3% of the first $10,000, regardless of what's involved. Savings account. Change the name of the account. Attorneys get 3% of $10,000. 2% of the next, and I don't remember the numbers, but I remember it was 2% of the next step and then 1% of the balance. Well, at the time, that was the huge hue and cry of the public. Attorney's fees and the California and Arizona statutes, and still today, in many states, still have the mandatory fee provisions. Well, that's what drove Terry Crakel and his cohort Stan Neelman, I believe it's his name, down at BYU, to propose the Uniform Probate Code. It was adopted initially by one state, Idaho, even though it was the Uniform Probate Code. It has now been adopted, I think, by 13 or 14 states, a number of states. And the main, number one, simplify the procedure. Simplify procedures so that the attorneys can choose how complex the probate procedure needs to be. Does it need to be supervised administration, which is basically similar to the old law where you have to go to court to get supervised decisions regarding every step? Or is there formal probate where you want the benefit of a final binding district or magistrate court decision regarding is the will valid? Is the person appropriately appointed as the personal representative? is the inventory asset. And you can pick and choose down through the process where you want to present an issue to the judge to get a formal order. In my experience, 90% of the filings are informal. The judge doesn't even act as a judge. He acts as a, and I can't remember the term, administrator, and basically says, the application looks okay, it looks like it complies with the law. Based on that, we're going to admit a rule of probate, and we're going to appoint X as the personal representative. And the system goes on from there. If anybody then later questions any of those informally done things, you can take it back to the magistrate and say, we want a formal binding decision on everybody as to whether the rule is valid or not, whether the personal representative is appropriately appointed. Well, in, for lack of a number, 90% of the probates that we do, we get an informal admission of the will of probate, an informally appointed personal representative, and that's, and we ask the magistrate to issue letters testamentary. The letters testamentary give the personal representative authority to go ahead. That's it. That's all the court supervision that ever occurs in the great majority of probates. The personal representative takes control of the assets, prepares an inventory which may or may not be filed with the court, communicates with all the heirs, they reach an agreement. Often we reduce that to a written settlement agreement, which is authorized by the probate code, and that's it. There is no memorandum of cost. There is no contested anything. And so you've got these two processes. You've got, under the probate code, there was a system by which attorney's fees, and let me use a different term, legal expenses, that's what the code refers to, legal expenses can be addressed. And if any interested party is adversely affected, they can raise the issue in front of the probate court as to whether the personal representative's payment of fees was appropriate. And technically speaking, the way we set it up is, it isn't the personal representative that pays fees out of his own checking account. We set up an estate checking account. The funds are deposited in the estate checking account. The personal representatives are the people that have the authority to pay expenses out of the estate account and does so. And under, I think it's 715, the personal representative has broad authority as to who to hire, whether it be surveyors or accountants or attorneys or whoever. As a matter of fact, I would suggest that in the great majority of cases, the personal representative has a fiduciary obligation to employ an attorney. If there's any complexity at all, and the personal representative just goes off on their own, doing whatever they want to do without following the law, they're breaching their fiduciary obligation to their clients. So I would argue they have a professional obligation to employ attorneys, in addition, obviously, to the statutory right to do so. And so, like I say, 90% of the cases, probate cases, there's never a final judgment. There's never a submission of a cost bill, like under 1221. It's just 720. If one of the interested parties contests it, there is a procedure to contest it. And we go right back to 1971. And the public complaining about excessive attorney's fees and an excessive complication or probate. And so the whole system is set up to stand on its own. Now let's move over to 12.121 and Rule 54. Rule 54, of course, talks about cost shifting. And let me go back. Another provision of 720 or 721, I don't recall which, says that not only is the personal representative entitled to hire an attorney, but is authorized to pay that attorney regardless of the result, regardless of the jurisdiction. I can end up in a probate case in front of the water court. I can end up in a probate case in front of the USDA. I can end up in probate court in front of the federal court. Regardless of what court, regardless of what jurisdiction, regardless of where I am, the personal representative is authorized to pay his attorney, regardless of result. Only requirement, the retention has to be in good faith. That's a statutory requirement, good faith. That's the only limitation. So let's switch over now to 12.121 and contested cases, which obviously drives 54, the Rules of Civil Procedure 54. And the basic requirements for 12.121 are, number one, there must be a prevailing party. Unlike the probate code, but regardless of the result, the person represented is authorized to pay his attorney out of the estate assets. No prevailing requirement on the probate side, very definitely a prevailing requirement. Not only is it a prevailing requirement, but also to trigger what 112 and 121 issue are unreasonable, frivolous, without foundation, and that test. Nothing like that is in the probate code. And so the two systems are just, they stand alone. They stand apart, and there just is very little tie.
To your point, doesn't Rule 54 specifically reference 12.121?
Yes, it does. Yeah, and it requires the standards. But to talk about 54 just for a second, and sort of going back to the probate code, 54E3, I think it was, it's since been amended. The 54E3, at the time, I think, of the Bailey decision, had this 11-factor test to determine the reasonableness of 12.121 fees. Well, the probate code picked up that test over on 54 and said, if we're determining reasonableness of attorney's fees under 721, under 53.721, what should the judges look to determine the reasonableness of those fees? Well, there's a test over there in 54 that really has application. It's a 10-factor test. And if you read 54E3 at the time, it said that this is applicable to 12.121 cases and all other cases involving the determination of fees. It isn't restricted to 12.121. So all it is a test in Rule 54 that the probate code made reference to the Bailey decision. That's what Bailey stood for.
Did we get it wrong in Bailey?
Did
we get it wrong? Did we get the law wrong in Bailey and how we approached all of this? I mean, because what you're saying makes an infinite amount of sense to me in terms of the dichotomy, but looking at Bailey, does it make sense? Does it follow what you're saying? I mean, if the PR can hire and pay the attorney, I mean, this requirement that we've laid out in Bailey, have we circumvented that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't understand where you're going. It makes total sense to me. 720, 721 requires a reasonable determination. Well, what? Is the practicing bar, the judiciary, suggesting we're going to have a new set of tests for bullet cases? Or is the same set of tests applicable in 12.121 in determination of reasonableness of fees? Is that a pretty good test to be applied over in the probate situation, which doesn't require a prevailing party, doesn't require unreasonableness, frivolous, and so forth. So,
I understand Mr. May's argument that Rule 54 imposes a tight deadline for submitting that memorandum, and if you don't submit it, that you've waived it.
Well, and I think that portion of Rule 54 has no application at all to 720. Totally stands alone. There's nothing in 720 that says you have to submit anything. As a matter of fact, the burden goes on the interested party who wants to contest it. And at that point, by you have a hearing, there's no memorandum. I mean, 90% of the cases, we just charge the attorney, the personal representative, he writes a check out of the state account, and that's it.
So 720 refers to the award of reasonable attorney's fees. And if 54 says here's factors to consider in determining whether a fee is reasonable, if an attorney doesn't, or a PR doesn't submit any sort of attorney fee statement in support of a request for reimbursement, how can the probate court decide these are reasonable attorney fees.
Excellent question. We routinely send a copy of our billing with our accounting, if that comes up. We don't file a memorandum of cost after the case is over. In our final accounting, with attorney's fees, $1,500. See attached memorandum. Here it is.
And so was a memorandum like that included with your final accounting in this case?
Yes, it was a final accounting. We very seldom get the final accountings. The great, great majority of probates are wound up informally. We don't bother the court and prepare a formal document that takes time and money for a $50,000 probate or $100,000 probate, which is it's counterproductive.
Right, and in this case, it looks like you did submit a final accounting. And so I'm wondering if when you submitted that and had a line item for phase one, $9,000 in fees, did you attach anything to substantiate the $9,000?
Yes, I did. Citra, I did not remember that. The record would reflect that. And perhaps the record in the first case, the first attorney case, would reflect that. Justice Edel, with respect to your question, I don't have it with me, but the record does contain a breakdown of phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four, and the attorney's fees that were incurred and what the services were on each of those. It's a 10 or 15 page itemization of things, so that does exist in the record.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So, let's talk just very briefly, about 12 and 21. It's a cost-shifting provision, and obviously this court has struggled with how to apply that. I think Minnick was one of the first cases that talked about that, and during all of our legal careers, we fought 12-121 in a variety of settings. Anybody who's been a trial attorney has lived with that. And the 12-121, first of all, does require litigated parties, and there's a question here. Is an estate, an independent estate, a party? And I argued in my brief, absolutely not. An estate is, in this case, a checking account. It is, it's an in-res proceeding. It's an asset. It is not a party. And so the idea that an estate is something separate and apart from the person representing, administering the estate is, just doesn't make sense. And that gets into the whole res judicata argument. Res judicata here, these are totally different parties involved. This is person represented versus the three devotees who are contesting it, and the estate is not a party. And so the appeal here, arguing that res judicata is based on the same parties and the same issues, is incorrect. Your final decision in the first hearing case was a 12-121 decision. This whole proceeding is not a review of your 12-121 decision at all. It's a question about the application of 15-720 and 715. And I really think the whole case is well resolved in the Bowman case. One paragraph of the Bowman case, and this side of the quote in my brief, just draws the distinction between fees under 720, and that case basically points out that both parties were requesting fees under 12-121 and under 720, and the Supreme Court said, determination of fees under 720 is not our responsibility. We are demanding that back to the magistrate to determine the reasonableness of fees incurred on the appeal. So that case said the magistrate determines whether the amount of fees that we incurred in the appeal, phase two, defending the appeal to Judge Simpson, phase three, defending the appeal to the Supreme Court. That case said all of those attorney's fees are to be considered by the magistrate on remand. Again, we're right back to 720. The attorney's fees incurred in any jurisdiction, regardless of result. And so that's an older case. I think it's a 101 Idaho case. But to me, that paragraph just resolves this whole discussion.
And so what we stand is we firmly believe that justice, that that District Judge Simpson was correct in his decision approving the fees for Phase 2, for Phase 3, and for Phase 4. And then on Phase 5, we switched over. Judge Simpson awarded 12-121 fees, saying that the appeal was frivolous and so forth, and there was a prevailing party. And we argued the same thing here. We submit that we the personal representatives, are entitled to personal to 12-121 fees on the appeal here. If there are more questions, I have nothing further.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And did the appellant use all the time?
Yes, Your
Honor. Very well. And with that, counsel, this matter is under advisement for the landing decision. Thank you. Thank you for the extra work of putting together the charts for us. That was helpful, and we appreciate that extra effort on your behalf. So the matter will be under advisement for decision. Thank you.
All right.